Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. Today we're diving into a topic that has fascinated me for a long time. Banners on the battlefield.
Exactly, and not as decoration, but as an absolutely indispensable tool. Imagine, you're standing there with maybe 8,000-10,000 other fighters. No radio, no mobile phone, no drone with a camera. How do you coordinate that?
That's actually something you need to wrap your head around first. At Hastings, the Anglo-Saxons stood on Senlac Hill, perhaps 700 to 800 meters of front line. In later battles, like Crecy, that could extend to a mile or more. And then, at dust, smoke, thousands of people and horses in between.
And that's exactly why they needed banners. They served three central functions: identification, who belongs to whom; reference point, where is my leader, where do I need to go; and third, symbol of honor. Your banner was your identity on the battlefield.
What many people don't consider: an individual fighter in the thick of battle often only had 10 to 30 meters of visibility. Helmets with eye slits, shields in front of your face, your own men all around you. That's when a banner held high above the heads
is the only thing you can still see over
the masses.
Yes, the large royal banners were deliberately held several meters high. With complex coats of arms, you could perhaps still recognize them at 200 to 400 meters. With simple high contrast banners, even up to 500-600 meters. But as soon as dust started swirling,
that was the end of any overview.
That's why there were banners at different levels. The large main banner for overall orientation, and then smaller pennants for individual groups. That way everyone had their reference point.
And then there's all the technique involved. The banners weren't just carried around casually. There was a real art of handling them, you could say.
Rolling up and unfurling sounds trivial, but it was extremely important. When the army was marching or getting into position, the banners were wrapped around the banner pole, ready for transport, compact, out of the way.
And the unfurling was then the signal.
Battle readiness. When you saw the banners being unfurled, then you knew, now it's getting serious. It was basically the medieval version of, how do I put this?
Red alert?
Yes, something like that. Or think of modern sports events. When the big flags are unfurled, it's game on. That visual signal still works today.
Ah, oh, true. It's basically the same principle. Except back then, it was a matter of life and death.
And that fits with the dimensions you mentioned at the beginning. At Hastings, for example, as already mentioned, the Anglo-Saxons stood on a front of about 700 to 800 meters. That's manageable if you know where to look.
But only from above or from behind. Anyone stuck in the thick of it needed those reference points above their heads. Otherwise, you'd have no chance of knowing whether you were even fighting in the right direction.
Which, by the way, also explains why commanders like to position themselves on high ground. Better view of their own banners, better control.
And the others could in turn look up to them.
An entire communication system long before any technology. Historical sources repeatedly describe how battlefields were literally covered with banners. Every faction, every important noble had their own.
A blaze of colors amidst the chaos. That must have been quite a sight.
An impressive one, and a vital one.
Now it gets really exciting, because carrying a banner, not just anyone could do that. Being a banner bearer was one of the most honorable positions of all. but at the same time, one of the most dangerous.
Quite a double-edged honor when you think about it.
The Templars took this extremely seriously. They had very specific regulations for it in their order statutes, spread across several articles, numbered differently depending on the edition. The marshal personally selected the banner bearer, and it couldn't be just any fighter.
But rather?
An experienced knight, battle-tested, extremely reliable, at least for the main banner, probably a knight of the order, not a mercenary. Sergeants could carry subordinate banners, though. Someone you could trust blindly.
That makes sense. As I said, the banner was the central reference point. If the bearer fails, the entire coordination collapses.
And that's why he also had to stay in the immediate vicinity of the marshal at all times. The banner was carried rolled up on the standard pole and could only be unfurled on direct order, never on one's own initiative.
And lowering the banner?
Was considered a serious offense. That was essentially the sign of defeat. Whoever let the banner drop was practically signaling surrender.
Enormous psychological pressure.
And now here's the paradox. These highly decorated, battle-tested knights were basically not supposed to actively fight, or only defensively, if at all.
That must have been frustrating. You're one of the best fighters, and then you're standing there with this banner and can't engage.
Not like the others, at least. The main task was position marking and signaling. The banner was more important than any single enemy you could have slain.
Although, to be fair, the rule didn't completely forbid all defense. But the banner could never be neglected. You couldn't just throw yourself into the fray.
The royal banner bearer was, incidentally, the most coveted position of all. Imagine, you carry the king's banner. Everyone on the battlefield knows where the king is, because he's with you.
Or at least near you. That's simultaneously the highest honor and, well, you're practically painting a target on your chest.
If you compare it to today, think of the flag bearers at the Olympic Games. They're not chosen randomly either. They're usually accomplished athletes, role models, who represent their country.
The difference, of course, at the Olympics, nobody's shooting at you.
You're right about that. But the principle of honor, of the representative function, that has remained remarkably similar over the centuries.
What impresses me, these men knew exactly what they were getting into. They knew the risk. And yet it was a position people applied for, not one they fled from.
Because the honor outweighed the danger. You were the visible representative of your lord, your order, your king. That meant something.
And if you fell, you fell for something greater than yourself.
The Templars took this to the extreme. For them, the Beauséant, that black and white order banner, was more than just cloth. It was the identity of the order on the battlefield.
A symbol men were willing to die for.
With the commitment to never let it fall.
To understand all of this in practical terms, living history groups have recreated such scenarios. A rider with a banner pole nearly 6 meters high, that was realistic for large sovereign banners, with a silt banner raised.
That's almost 2 stories high.
If you hold it upright, yes. And now the challenge. You're sitting on a horse and you're supposed to ride with it. Rolled up, the whole thing was still relatively...
easy to handle?
The banner hung stably on the pole, hardly got in the way. Even at higher speeds, no problem. Galloping, maneuvering, all doable.
That's the purpose of rolling it up. You need freedom of movement until the decisive moment arrives.
But then they unfurled the banner. And that's when the fun started.
Fun as in chaos?
Total chaos. Even in a light breeze, the thing wrapped itself around horse and rider. The silk flutters everywhere. The horse suddenly can't see anything. The rider is fighting with fabric.
Instead of the enemy?
Yes. Just imagine that happening on an actual battlefield. You're carrying the banner of a duke or count, and then you look like a tent caught by the wind.
While the battle rages around you, nobody's going to take you seriously anymore.
The reenactment showed the timing of unfurling was crucial. Unfurl too early and you have exactly this problem. Too late and your troops have no orientation.
And you couldn't control the wind. That was luck or bad luck.
Although experienced banner bearers surely learned to read the wind.
Direction. They knew every sign. Blades of grass, dust, how their shirt felt against their body.
That was definitely not a skill you learn in an afternoon.
And then the horse. It also had to be accustomed to the fluttering fabric first. That's anything but trivial.
In the reenactment, this became very apparent. The horse shied at first.
Of course, horses are prey animals. Anything that flutters, rustles, moves unpredictably, that signals danger from a horse's perspective. Getting them used to it, the so-called desensitization, takes weeks to months, depending on the animal.
With modern horses, what was it like with...
War horses? They had to endure much more. Noise, crowding, clanging of weapons, the smell of blood.
So the training of the horses was at least as important as that of the riders themselves.
Oh, definitely. Without a rock-solid horse, you'd be lost as a banner bearer. Your horse makes one jump to the side because the banner flutters.
And suddenly you're lying in the dirt, with your lord's banner underneath you.
The absolute nightmare.
This reenactment makes clear the respect these men deserve. They mastered this, with real fabric, real wind, in real battles, without practice runs in a safe paddock.
And with the knowledge that every mistake was not just embarrassing, but potentially fatal.
During the reenactment, you could laugh when things went wrong. On the battlefield of Crécy or Agincourt, not so much.
Let's delve deeper into the tactics. Because unfurling a banner was, as already suggested, not a spontaneous decision, but a precisely timed action with real consequences.
At the start of a battle, banners were often still rolled up from the march. The unfurling could have symbolic meaning.
At least as long as the banner was still rolled up, you couldn't see the coat of arms. But actually, banners were meant for identification and orientation. So in battle formation, they were usually visibly unfurled to show who was standing there.
Was there a coordinated signal for that?
There were probably signals for certain main banners, like the Oriflamme with the French, whose raising was a symbolic political act. The Templars also had fixed rules for banner handling. But whether all banner bearers unfurled in coordination isn't really documented. Still, when an army stood in battle formation with all those banners, that must have been an impressive sight.
And psychologically extremely effective. For your own troops, it was a morale boost. This is it. Now we show who we are.
The banner provided not only orientation, but also identity. You're not fighting alone. You're fighting for this coat of arms, for this lord, for this cause.
But the timing had to be perfect.
Right. Unfurled too early and the banner could get tan.
Gleed in the wind, just like in the reenactment.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
Unfurled too late. And your troops have no orientation when the attack begins. The window was small.
And you constantly had to keep multiple factors in mind at once.
Wind direction, wind strength, the terrain ahead of you, possible obstacles, and of course the movements of your own formation. This wasn't a job for someone who gets nervous easily.
Multitasking on the battlefield. While the fighting rages around you.
Obstacles were particularly treacherous. A tree, a wall, even a rider who suddenly crosses your path, and the banner gets caught. Sudden maneuvers could cause the banner to get tangled or even pull the bearer off his horse.
The terrain was never ideal. Battlefields weren't exactly chosen for ergonomic considerations.
Unfortunately not. And then the weather came into play. Rain made the fabric heavier. Mud from below if the banner ever touched the ground.
Blood. That happened too.
Maintenance was a constant challenge. A banner that looked too battered was also a bad signal for morale.
What actually happened when a banner was torn or lost?
That was a catastrophe. In the worst case, your own troops thought their leader had fallen. Orientation was lost. But with larger armies, there were multiple field signs. Vassal banners, city banners, pennants of subordinate commanders. All distinct symbols that could then serve as reference points.
Redundancy in the system.
Just like with any critical communication system, a single failure couldn't be allowed to bring down the entire network.
It's fascinating how well thought out all of this was. We are not talking about spontaneous flag waving here, but about a sophisticated tactical instrument.
The size of the banners also varied strategically. The royal banner was significantly larger than those of individual knights, so it could be identified from further away. But larger also means harder to handle, more susceptible to wind.
A compromise between visibility and practicality.
Like so much on the battlefield. And the banner bearers had to weigh all these factors in split seconds, while simultaneously watching out for the next arrow coming their way.
Now we come to perhaps the darkest aspect of this topic. Banner bearers were extremely vulnerable on the battlefield.
They had this conspicuous position, mounted on horseback, the banner above everyone's heads. Everyone could see them. And at the same time, they could hardly defend themselves.
One hand on the banner, the other maybe on the reins. That doesn't leave much for a sword or shield. This made them prime targets.
If you take out the banner bearer, you throw the enemy formation into chaos. They lose their orientation, their morale.
Their reference point.
There's a historical example that illustrates this very clearly. The Battle of Bosworth, 1485.
Richard III personally killed the enemy's banner bearer there. The English king, the last Plantagenet king, rode directly at Henry Tudor's standard.
That was a targeted attack on the enemy's symbol.
Richard knew exactly what he was doing. Take the banner, and you take part of the enemy's identity. That he himself fell in the process is another story, but the attack on the banner bearer was calculated.
And for the banner bearers themselves, it must have been a conflicted existence.
On one hand, the greatest honor. You carry the symbol of your lord, your king. Everyone sees you. Everyone knows who you are.
And on the other hand, you can't fight. You stand there while your comrades risk their lives. And you're holding cloth.
Although, of course, this cloth was more than...
Sure, symbolically enormously important. But try explaining that to your combat instinct. You're a trained knight, prepared for close combat, and then you're not allowed to engage.
And the worst part? You could never let the banner fall, under any circumstances. Even if you were being attacked. Even if you were wounded.
Dropping the banner was considered a disgrace, a loss of honor. Being wounded was the lesser evil.
So you had to endure. Hope your comrades would protect you, and at the same time hold the banner high, no matter what happened.
These men deserve enormous respect. They put their duty above their own survival.
And when we see banners today, at festivals, at reenactments, at sports events, they still hold a fascination. Those billowing colors, that symbolic power.
Oh yes, there's something primal about it. A banner gathers people, gives them a sense of belonging.
And that has worked for centuries. The technology has changed, but the fundamental effect hasn't.
That's it for today. We hope you enjoyed this topic as much as we did.
If you found this topic interesting, feel free to visit battlemerchant.com. In our blog, you will find many more fascinating articles about medieval history and, of course, an extensive range of products for anyone who doesn't just want to read about history, but experience it.
Until next time.
Take care.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your swords sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.